Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is April 10th, 2012. Now, folks, don't forget to send in your recipes for inclusion in the Exogenic Cookbook. Just put them in the email tonight and get them emailed to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com, and we're going to have another drawing soon from those submissions, so don't wait. Now, tonight we're starting off with a fantastic series. And just like all of our other programs, I would love to have the audience input with questions and comments. So if you join the virtual auditorium in Pal Talk, you can send them to me via text. And if you're listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. All of our guests also have pages on our website, so you can click on their names in the left-hand column and go straight there. Our listeners can also find our guest list there so you know who's on which show. Lots of great information can be found there, as well as links to blogs, Facebook, Twitter, and even Google+. And with the start of the Native American Voices series, we also have the very great fortune of having Keith Cicola as my guest co-host. So Keith, you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience.
Okay, my name is Keith Cicola. I'm a Anishinaabe from northern Minnesota, Boys Fort, and Kuchiching from southern Ontario, in the border country of Minnesota and Ontario. But I currently live in Arizona, where I write songs and I perform nationally and internationally. And today I'm writing a blog, you know, a blog about these songs that I've written and hosting and co-hosting this this internet radio show, and so this is what brings me at this intersection, and I'm very happy to be here and kind of prod it along and bring it along to where the intersection is contemporary American Indian news and topics and a little bit of humor and a little bit of music and a little bit of educating people. And I'm so happy to have our guest today, Michael. And so well, buddy, and my name is Keith, and I'm your co-host.
And Mike Graham, he is from the United Native America. So, Mike, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, it's an honor to be on your show here today and go over this topic with your audience out here. I'm a citizen of the Oklahoma Cherokee Nation. I formed United Native America back in 1993 and actually started the group up in 1988, first going to the Cherokee Nation Council, asking them to draft a tribal resolution calling on the federal government to bring about a national holiday recognizing American Indians. And to this date, we finally got it accomplished in 2007 with the help of our California Congressman Barca's office. They passed a resolution to the House and fixed the date on the day after Thanksgiving with a name and a date that our group is not happy with, but at least we got it established and we went along with that part. So we're still continuing on right now trying to overturn Columbus Day as a federal tax-paid recognized holiday, and working with Italian groups around the country trying to get them to understand where we're coming from, that Columbus and his Holocaust, initiating the Holocaust against American Indians here, does not represent their history, their heritage here in this country, and the American Indians are standing up against him being honored, and our tax dollars paying for his holiday and not even have one for our history and heritage here in the helping and forming of America. Over the past 20 years here, I've traveled around the country, talked to tribal leaders across the country, worked with other groups in demonstrations on their issues in other states and everything, and taking on corporate America and their racial exclusion of American Indians in our movie industry, sports industry, advertising the way the Holocaust has come down from the battlefield as to the corporate world. And our national news media blacking out any really social issues that the American Indians have that would, you know, should be presented to the nation as other ethnic and racial groups are getting their issues presented nationally. The news media is blacking out Native American Indian issues still today, and that's an ongoing circle there between the federal, state governments, and our national media doing this to us. And we're trying to get that eliminated.
Uh-huh. And, you know, when you actually pay attention to things like there's Black History Month, and libraries are all across the nation do all sorts of things to educate people about Black history, yet at the same time, there isn't an equivalent for Native America, is there?
Well, you have November is American Indian Heritage Month. This is where the racial exclusion of American Indian Indians even having anything to do with this country. The media and the advertising companies in corporate America, you know, turn their back on it and act like it doesn't even exist. And if you, you know, if you send an email or call Fox and try to get them to say, hey, can you at least say the day this, you know, 1st of November, hey, this is American Indian Heritage Month, would that chap y'all's butt too much? It pisses them off.
We don't hear much about Native America other than, you know, the usually silent role in children's Thanksgiving plays. You know, they come carting the pumpkin pie or whatever in. And, you know, that's it. You know, and Native Americans, they're usually portrayed as wearing feathers, very long, dancing around and chasing settlers in a circle around their wagons. And if they say anything, it's usually how, ugh, or kimosabe. Which, by the way, everybody, that's not a real word in any language. That was a made-up word, just for Hopwood.
It kind of fits in with, to me, I see it all kind of fits in with a couple of doctrines. One even being the doctrine of discovery, and the other important thing, the manifest destiny. If you looked at even the way Edward Curtis would portray American Indians in never in contemporary fashion, would almost be like the whole doctrines did complete their mission of extermination of our peoples. And so they never do want to carry us into the contemporary world as who we are and what we do. And I think it's you can see it in art, you can see it in music, you can feel it in social and economical ramifications of who we are in this complex world of being American Indian. I think it's when you say any subject, I mean, there's so many views and so many angles in totally understanding this concept, you know. And so when I see things like that, I can exclusion almost on purpose. And it's almost like they're making us stand up for some false hope. And that gets to a point of desperation sometimes. And I think if we can release that desperation, we can really move forward into really moving to some of these things concretely into reality by, you know, by our people, you know, such as Mike's movement and things that he's doing to bring bring a manifestation of consciousness, you know, bring it to reality, bring the symbol of our survival to actual contemporary news, to bring it to a memorial in 2012 or whenever the year comes. And so those are a couple of the things I see in what both of the, everybody's thinking and saying.
Now, I know that a lot of people wonder, why am I doing this particular series on Native American voices, and what is my goal? Essentially, you know, I'm letting everybody know. I mean, Mike, Keith, you kind of know already because we talked about this, but I wanted to bring information to the mainstream that isn't portrayed in our history books and textbooks at school, that it's not portrayed in Hollywood, it's not... these things aren't heard of away from the reservations often. And many, many people that have Native American ancestors have lost any connection with who they came from. And without knowing who those people are today, it's going to be even more difficult to find out who you came from in your own past. And maybe sometimes things like why your family does things the way they do, and so forth and so on. By reclaiming your own heritage, whether, you know, you come from me like a mixed bag of people from all over the place, or whether you know that you are a member of such and such group or such and such tribe, and you belong to this kind of clan, for the many, many people that are mixed with many things, they don't have that connection. And to get a realistic view of where you came from, you really do have to understand where they are now as well. So that's part of the reason, everybody. So listen up, and, you know, many of you may have Native American ancestors in your own heritage, and be curious about who they were and who they are now. And this is an opportunity that maybe you can get some firsthand information from people like Mike and Keith, and on your own journey of understanding. So, Mike, I know that the topic that you wanted to talk about was the Indian Holocaust. And a lot of people don't know about it, maybe never heard of the things that happened. And in many, many groups, there's still a lot of regional animosity between both sides. Even though those battles ended so long ago, they still affect us today.
Yes, it's still ongoing today. It's gone from the battlefield of the U.S. Cavalry raiding Indian villages and slaughtering men, women, and children, the federal government, state governments issuing bounties for the scalps of Indian men, women, and children. This was U.S. policy. And to put it into the terms of the Holocaust is that the American Indian population here, North America and everything, was estimated to be over 100 million people was killed from the time Columbus landed up until the U.S. Army, Canada, and through South America armies down there killing people, that it came out that they had killed that many, estimated that many people had perished. And the way they were treated by the invasion forces from Columbus up to, and including all the way up into the 70s, we found out here that the federal government's policy with American Indian Health Services was that Indian women coming to health clinics with virtually minor health problems were not even asked or told, but they were given, they were screened, and they were sterilized from having babies ever at young ages. And this came to light by a Choctaw lady there in Oklahoma that put the information together from all the clinics around the country and found out that it was a standard practice, that this was being carried out up into the 70s even, to eliminate the American Indians. And Jim Crow laws came about from George Washington and the presidents on up to President Lincoln there, and federal law that an American Indian could not cross a state border without permission from that state government and have the authorization from the state government that he was going into, that he wouldn't stay there, that he was moving on through. And the Imprisonment Act back there in the 1600s there around Boston, I played a part with the tribal groups there of getting that taken off of the Boston City laws, that an American Indian could be put to death if he was found within the city limits of Boston. That was still a law up until just a few years ago on their books. And through our efforts, we finally got the mayor there to petition the state, which they had to there, to do away with any law. And the state government there in Massachusetts finally took that law off the books, the American Indian Imprisonment Act. And it was done through Georgia and other states across the country that an American Indian could not be within the city limits of any town, dark. They had to leave. And that's why you don't see
a lot of people,
you know, that's
don't
why you
realize.
Don't see no white, you see white and black bathroom signs of the South. They didn't have to worry about having one for the Indians. If the Indians were in town that day, they used the black restrooms. But they weren't there at night. So that law forbid them for, you know, for even being in, couldn't be in Atlanta, Georgia. Because they'd already...
A lot of people don't realize until the Snyder Act in 1927, American Indians were not a citizen of the United States. Period.
That's right. I mean, that's where it's at. The Civil War under President Lincoln. Everybody, hallelujah, you know, salami's this guy, praises him for his civil rights stand in the Civil War and the whole nine yards. But they don't know that in Minnesota he conspired with the governor at the time during the Civil War and authorized America's largest mass hanging of American Indian men, 38-39 Indian men. They were set to hang 300, and Lincoln chickened out because he feared hanging 300 Indian men at that time would alienate and hack off the European nations against the North fighting during that time in the Civil War, and they cut it down to around 30 and hanged them and put the other 200-something Indians in prisons in the state and left them there to die, to take their land. And Lincoln also promised them $2 million if they would go along with his proposal. And after the Civil War, he promised them that he would rid them of their Indian problem. And this is all in writing from President Lincoln to the state governor there of that state.
Uh-huh.
This is not told in our classrooms for good reasons. You know.
Well, I know that in talking with people, okay, because... You know, this isn't the first conversation I've had about Indian issues. But I was talking with some women who were, you know, they seemed old to me at the time, but they were probably the age that I am now when I was talking to them. But even as late as the 60s, there was a bounty paid for Indian children to be kidnapped from their parents and brought to boarding schools, and their parents could not get them back.
No, this
and
was done all
the parents
through
weren't
Oklahoma.
Given permission. It was done all through the United States.
After the trail of tears of Andrew Jackson going against the Supreme Court, telling him that he was not authorized as president to use the U.S. Army to force all American Indians from the East Coast west of the Mississippi, he told them, go to hell, enforce your law against me. And he ordered the army to push them westward, and that's when the Trail of Tears came about with all the Indian nations being forced west of the Mississippi. Once they were back here and going through starvation and stuff through the winters and everything, and no supplies or nothing back here, all these tribes mixed in together trying to figure out how they were going to stay a tribal nation and what land was theirs and where they could get food from and get their shelter and everything made up. Federal government comes in with army posts and everything, and then here comes the deal that, hey, like you can't feed your children, you can't take care of them, so, you know, you got to let these children go to boarding schools, and we're going to build the schools over here, and they're going to go there, and you stay over here. All the boarding school thing about. And from the boarding schools, they got them adopted out, and the deal was, whenever the land, the Oklahoma land was all theirs to the tribal nations. Then when they had the land rush, that all went away. Then it was with the Indian children, they allotted them so much acreage. And the deal was, everybody was scrambling to adopt Indian children because they were getting anywhere from 500 to 1,000 acres of land. And when they discovered oil there in Oklahoma and everything, that's whenever they really hit a big boom on getting the Indian children adopted out. Because with my grandmother, she was one of 20 children to one man and woman. They had 20 adopted Indian children that all were allotted land. And her land was in Sequoia County and Rogers County. And in Rogers County, that's where a lot of the big oil fields were. And he sold all that land before she turned 18, because what they were doing was putting all these Indian children down by law. If they were full blood, the adopted parents couldn't sell their land. They had to hold it till they was 18, and then it was rightfully the child's. But if they were half put down as half Indian, then if you needed the money to support that child, you could cede land before they were 18, and all these full-blood Indian children were being put down as half-breeds, and the parents were selling their land out to oil companies and stuff. So you have tens of thousands of American Indians throughout Oklahoma and other states where this was carried out. They were put down as half Indian when they were actually full-blood to get around the law.
Mm-hmm. So the kids became a tool,
a commodity,
to move the land out of Indian hands and into the corporate hands.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of appalling. And I know, too, that, you know, experiments, some rather gruesome ones. I talked to a woman who was Yellow Medicine Sioux, and as a six-year-old child, they said that she had tuberculosis. And they took her away from her family, and they sent her to Oklahoma because she had tuberculosis, and that's where she had to go. And this would have been in the 60s. And as an experimental treatment for her case of tuberculosis, they removed the lung. That's like crazy stuff. I mean, that's 1800s kind of thing. So on a six-year-old child, they removed the lung.
To the West Coast, and, you know, they dreamed up stuff. And as the other gentleman, your friend here on the program with us, was saying about the manifest destiny from the federal government from the East Coast to the West Coast, we call it the federal government manifest holocaust from the federal government. And that manifest, it was for the U.S. Army to push the Indians off their land, make it suitable for white population farmers, and squeeze them in as tight as they could on smaller parcel of land in the middle of nowhere as they could, then surround them with forts and keep them there until the health and living conditions took them out. And if they tried to break off those reservations to get out to feed their families and stuff, there in Hollywood had their thrills through the, you know, early days of TV up into the 50s and 60s there, the U.S. cavalry coming to the rescue of the pioneers, the Indians, the savages are going to kill them all, you know. That's the way it was portrayed to me and other millions of other kids growing up in America in those years. And that, you know, hasn't changed today, because on the flip side of it, I know for a fact on the Indian reservations right now, as I discussed with you earlier a few days ago, that Indian reservations, 90% of the teachers are white. And I had it out with the university teacher up there in Montana concerning this issue, And he said, well, the Indian students, they want to go to California where they can get higher pay and everything. And I said, what's the payoff for a white person coming from California and living up here and getting little pay to be out here, stuck out here teaching Indian kids on a reservation? What's up with that? There's still that systematic control thing going on there.
And the question comes from Mr. G.R. How did we separate the media stereotype of those Indian American groups like the ones you see in movies from the Native activist reality?
Well, I think we got to do it through the arts. It's a very thing, and let people draw their conclusion. We can't change their mind because they're not ready to. We got to let them see the truth, and it's almost like using arts to illuminate truth. You know, like when you're talking about the ordinance in Boston that prohibited American Indians in the proximity of the town vicinity. They hung King Philip's head for 20 years. It stood on the end of a spigot in the town center. And so the crudeness of Indian wars and Indian hating, you know, it's absurd. And of the 39 that was hung in Mankato, one of them was a little 9-year-old girl, a little 9-year-old Sioux girl. And so, like, yes, it's, you know, like, well, how do we not make this sickness make us angry and become hateful? And if we do, we almost become no change agents. We become an agent for not change. And that's the hardest things for, I think our age group that I'm experiencing as a Native American male, that you're aware of this extermination and you're aware of all these false hopes. But you're also aware that you can't turn your back on your grandma or your mother or your father or your brother or sister. And so that is ironic, you know, and I think that's a very good question for people. How do we separate these? How do we educate? How do we promote? And how do we preserve? You know, what are the things we do?
The manner we're doing it through with United Native America is that in my travels, I'm doing the radio and TV broadcast and talking at schools across the country. And my proposal to them is that we know no one here today was alive back in 1800s when the full brunt of the federal government termination laws were in effect against the American Indians in forming America. We're not blaming no one here today. What we're doing is explaining how it went from the battlefield to corporate America, federal government, and our mass media here in the United States, racially excluding American Indians.
I'm doing a live internet radio show right now.
Well, yeah, you know,
you won't hear a program like this on CNN or Fox News television, national networks. You'll get it on simulcast here on the internet, like this program and stuff, or a local area that's primarily like in, you know, New Mexico, Oklahoma, or Arizona, predominantly American Indian community. But when you go east and out west here to California and these states here, they really don't want to hear what you have to say. And that's what we're trying to break
through. There's a saying, you know, that is very true. And a fanatic never changed anybody's mind. And it's really hard when you look at some of the really bad things that have happened and continue to happen to not be really angry. So, you know, we still have to figure out a way. And it's almost like those of us who have mixed heritage, we have to bring all of that together and understand it all in order to become a whole person ourselves. And it's the same thing for this nation. We have to accept, we have to, you know, look at it realistically and accept, okay, it happened. We have to understand it in order to make sure it never happens again. Because there again, there's one of those other old things, you know, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. We don't want to repeat that. And we don't need to repeat it ever again.
So we have to find a way to integrate the nation that we are today and include Native Americans as an equal and important part of it, because they were a very important part of who we are today. Many people don't realize how much of Native American ideology went into the formation that our founding fathers coalesced into what we call our Constitution, what we call our Bill of Rights, and so forth and so on. All those things came from, guess what? Native America.
When
those were very important contributions.
I traveled a long time with the Native activist Floyd Westerman, who also was doing a series on the Holocaust in California, where he started. But he did a similar TV thing. And Floyd and I would often have conversation of the nature of protest songs and how it can be delivered. And he would tell me from his school, his old school, like the Dylan and Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, you know, they would just hit him right on the head or kick him in the shins with truth. But he liked particularly how I would be part of this new school of leading people to a gentle, leading them gently to a brutal truth. You know, I'd get them to sing and be happy about fried bread. And then I would say, you know, fried bread killed as many Indians as the federal government. You know, truth. Hit them with the truth and let people kind of lead their way to finding out the discoveries. And I think a little blend of both schools of education is almost a necessary way. You know, I don't know, Gee, I sent you a WAVE file of this song called Open the Door, and it's almost a chronicalization of all the brutal dates in American Indian history, you know, all the way up to contemporary. But all these dates I use, guys, everybody's, I'm sure, you know, if people are listening and have their stories, have their stories, their dates and things like that. And so I think the arts, and I think the medias, and I think the laws, all these things are all part of this, this people of the new fire, people coming from all directions. They say that we are in the eighth fire, Anishinaabe's prophecies, that in this eighth fire that people will come forward from all directions, and we won't need a leader. People will be able to lead themselves, and that's one way of leading them, is lead them to the truth.
Mm-hmm. What do you think there, Mike? Do you think we can put this all together and link our history together,
the plot of the American Indians and the formation of America, we go at it from the realist point that everybody knows what the Jewish people went through in World War II. Worldwide, there was around 100 million people killed, and we're told around 6 million Jews were persecuted by the Nazis.
Uh-huh.
The follow-up deal to that is Hitler himself, when he was a young boy, growing up, he was fascinated with Hollywood movies of Custer, the Calvary, going after the Indians, killing them, forcing them on reservations. That's where Hitler learned how to conduct his Holocaust against the Jewish people. It's a stated fact.
Ignorance is our biggest enemy, and he used people's ignorance of the Jewish people essentially to create that animosity. And we see the same thing has happened here. You know, Indians don't live in teepees, they don't wear feathers in their hair, and they're not out in buffalo and shooting them with bows and arrows. That's not who they are today. Just like today, you know, white society has changed a great deal. Native Americans have changed as well. And what we need to see happen now is a greater acceptance of their culture, as well as creating some economic and educational opportunities.
Well, in a manner, like I say, in a manner of the way the federal government took control from the East Coast to the West Coast, the only thing our schools are doing today, they're slowly but surely trying to implement how it happened during that time toward the American Indians and the effects those federal policies had on the American Indian community in that area during that time. That's being brought in now, slow but sure.
Uh-huh.
And there's still a lot of resistance for that to even take place. We get it all the time that we're told it's not factual, it's not this, it's not that, and it's archived in Washington, D.C. And the federalism, separation of government powers, like you said earlier, and freedom of speech under government rule came from the American Indian nations, or America, did not come from Europe, did not come from Africa or Asia. It was homegrown right here with the Indian nations, and the so-called founding fathers picked up on that from the Six Nations and the Eastern Coast tribal nations, and they formed their government that way, and they at least, in the American Indian Heritage Month resolution through the Senate and House, they acknowledged that much, that it was a blueprint copy of the Indian Nation tribal governments at the time. When this country was formed and the powers were separated as they are today. And getting schools to teach that, is like trying, trying to get a... It's hard.
Yeah, and it's changing of the way everyone looks at things. Maybe I got a unique view. I'm going to tell a little story here. My son was about 3 or 4 years old, and he started fussing and fighting with his sister when we were traveling in the car. And my mother was driving, and she stopped alongside the highway, and she told the kids that, fight. Listen, leave you here till you're done, fight. And because everybody knows how kids get swallowed in a car, and we happened to be on the Navajo Nation at the time. And there was an abandoned Hogan in the distance. And all of a sudden, my son looks out and sees the Hogan, and he says, "You want them to take my hair?" And I'm like, "What? They're going to take my hair. They're going to make me dead." And I'm like, "What in the world did he come up with this stuff?" Because obviously it wasn't something I had done. And, I couldn't figure it out. And so we would introduce him to various friends. And we'd say, this is so-and-so, and they're from such-and-such tribe. "No, you're not." I'm like, "Whoa, where's your feathers?" And so forth and so on. And, this went on for a long, long time. And I had no idea where it had come from. And one day, I'd gotten out a box of old cassette tapes, and I plunked one in. It was called Wacky Weirdos. I still remember that. And the song "Please, Mr. Custer" came on, which is a silly, innocuous song, or so I had thought. I never thought of it as representing Indians at all, but to a child, it did. And that song, that's where they said that
Do I still have a connection?
Yeah, I can hear you, Mike.
Okay.
Can hear.
I thought she finished speaking. I didn't hear.
A question I want to ask you is, at what age did you become aware of all these atrocities? Was it when you, as growing up as Native, you're conscious of tribal histories, but at what age and how did you become aware?
Did I become knowledge of how American Indians were treated?
Yeah, hi, Jay. I think we lost you a little while. Mike and
I
are kind of carrying on a conversation.
There.
But I just asked him, in a kind of a follow-up to your question about your son, where did he learn these things? And you've seen that song, "Please, Mr. Custard."
Song.
Don't you? I remember that song, too. And the question I asked Mike is, at what age and where did he learn both things I want to ask him? First of all, become consciously aware of all the atrocities, but also aware of all the mishaps, the misquotes, the stereotypes, and things like that.
I can tell you firsthand how it started with me, and it started with me in a small school, grade school, when I was in the fourth grade. Mike was an Indian racist. And during the fourth grade, he mentally abused me, physically beat me, and tortured me for the entire school year of my fourth grade, to the point of threatening me that if anyone found out this was going on or whatever, he terrorized me. He would take me out of the classroom saying, you know, I don't need no damn Indian in my classroom. He'd take me out of the classroom and outside and lock me up in the school car with the windows up. And he said not to get out of that car until he come back and let me out. And every Friday, regardless of what I made on a test, he'd take me in the office and make me bend over and grab my ankles, and he would ball bat me with a paddle, knocking me head over heels into the wall, and I'd have to get back up in position and re-grab my ankles for the next 9 licks. And then one day, toward the end of the school year there, he just went ballistic on me and whipped me with a belt and a paddle, and the next day I couldn't get out of bed. I was so bruised up and black and blue from the chest down, and my mom seen it and everything, and that's when it all came out, you know, what he was doing to me, because he terrorized me. You know, it's basically like, you know, if you say anything about this, you won't be able to stay in school here, and you'll be taken away from your mom and dad, and you'll be put in an Indian school. And that's the way he would talk to me all the time. This was every day of the fourth grade. Okay, all I did to him was freaking fire him. Now that's my firsthand experience of it, you know, in the 50s, because I had mixed Indian and white heritage. Then I was drafted right out of school. We had race relation classes in the Army, and all they wanted to do was talk about the black and white problem, the black and white problem. I got fed up with it. I said, why don't you guys ever talk about, you know, the racism toward American Indian? And man, did I open up a can of worms there. It basically, I think, went in on my record that, here's a troublemaker. No, we're going to keep the issue on the blacks and whites, not in mothers, you know. And that's basically the
attitude I got. Yeah, I'm going to ask you guys a question here right now. You know, I was told that one of the things that they did to Native Americans in the service and other places, especially like during the 60s and 70s, is they would frequently call you chief. And, you know, is that insulting? Is that something that's considered, you know, as insulting as I think it would be?
If it comes from a stranger being snot-nosed about it, yeah, I'd grab him by the neck. If it's one of my buddies that has no Indian heritage or nothing like that there, it's just horseplay stuff.
Right.
A lot of times, because my name is Keith, I say, hey, what's your name? I say, Keith Sekola. And they'll say, Chief Sekola? And humor immediately enters into the fray, you know, as far as, and then sometimes you might get so tired of the thing, you might just say yes, you know, but it is kind of like how it's used and where it's used. And, you know, personally, you know, I wouldn't really do that to one of my friends who is Native or not. You know, I don't think I would just do it as a joke even, you know, but that's just me.
Yeah. And another term that you frequently hear that, you know, I kind of regard as less than courteous, I guess, would be the reference of Indian women as squaws.
That one is
now,
a big one.
Now, to mainstream society, you know, they don't think anything of it. I've used it like a news stuff.
Well, the Piestewa Peak in Arizona was called Squaw Peak, you know, up to 10 years ago when they got it to change to an Indian woman, the first Native woman who was killed in Marine action, Lori Piestewa. And they just recently got that peak changed from Squaw Peak to, even the Squaw Peak Highway was called, now it's called, you know, US 51 or something like that. But that was a big issue, you know, like just educating people how vulgar that was.
We got involved in on that with the state government there and all the Indian haters there around Phoenix and Tucson. They were threatening riots and everything else against the Indian community and everything else if the state government went through with that proposal to change Squaw Peak over there to that Indian lady's name. And it was an internet blow up on the boards and everything, and everybody sending faxes and phone calls to the Arizona state representatives. But, you know, thank goodness the governor had a backbone and stood up to him and got it put through.
Yeah, she did. And, you know, and I live in Tempe, right in Phoenix Valley. You know, I've hiked up that peak, and it's a gorgeous area that mountain preserve was in. Unfortunately, it's an island, you know, where the Stucco Glacier is, encroached on all sides of the mountain peak and the mountain reserve in Phoenix. But the peak itself is a wonderful peak, and it is a spiritual peak. And, you know, like for that to be, to be named, that was a misname, which clouded the issue because, you know, that brought up a lot of what Mike was saying about the polarization of Indian hating, and it brought out the worst in people. You know, my neighbors or people that I knew who would stand on the other side of the naming issue because of the misuse of the word, you know, even the word squaw man, you know, I remember that being said as a young person to you by bullies, you know, meaning that maybe your dad married an Indian woman or something like that, or what did that mean? And then the reference to the genital references to a woman's body parts of the word vagina in the relationship to the word squaw. It was just a vulgar word, and the caligula of the word ran its course. I mean, it's an overused, underly appropriate word, and so thank God, you know, like things have kind of changed in that direction, you know, but I still hear people slip of the tongue will, you know, say, I'm going to go on the Squaw Peak Highway, take it home tonight.
Well, across America, going on back there when I was growing up was, in most of the cities across the United States, the one sign you would see in the storefront was no dogs, no Indians allowed. And that went on real strong up into the 70s even.
Yeah.
See, I grew up in an area that was completely and totally very white. Everybody descended from Dutch and German immigrants. And so, you know, we didn't have neighbors who were Native American or black or Hispanic or anything else. You know, I stood out in the classroom as being unusually dark. And I'm not, really, you know. And so the thing is, you know, that my first learning about Native Americans was a field trip. We go to Spirit Lake and we visit, I forget the name of it, but it was a cabin that had been preserved, and it was a site of what they called the Spirit Lake Massacre. And so they gave you this gruesome story about how the entire family was slaughtered and the baby had its head bashed in, and these two girls were taken captive and hauled away. Horrible things were done to them, and so forth and so on. And you even had some writings that was done by one of the girls, Abigail something or another was her name, when she became an adult and referred to her year of captivity. And so they were presented, the Sioux were presented in a very negative way. And, you know, almost as though, hey, you know, if you go to where the Sioux live, you're apt to have your brains bashed in, or they're going to do horrible things to you. And so, you know, you're trying to integrate that with what you're told by your mother, and, you know, there really wasn't any place to bring it together, because I was only given one side of the story. And obviously there were two sides to that story. But, you know, that's often the only exposure that many people will ever have to a story involving Native Americans.
As far as the racial hatred and everything, I mean, there's no one on earth that would deny the American Indians the right to hate the federal government for its manifest Holocaust policies and the horrific effect it played in destroying the population of American Indians in this country, Canada, Mexico, South America. It was an atrocity that's matched by no other group, race, creed, religion, people on earth, as it was carried out on this continent, the Western continent, in the conquering of it, and the manner it was done in did not have to happen the way it did. It was done out of pure evil and greed. And that's what they don't want to come to light today. But other countries around the world knows how this federal government came to power and Canadian government came to power. They know how they got their governmental control over the people here. And
I think, Mike, do you agree with the... What do you think of the fact that a lot of time that in the frontiers and seeing that the interaction was a lot more peaceful than that people would realize, that there was more human interaction, and that the war was kind of like glamorized and sensationalized, and we didn't hear about the actual part of people working together?
No,
right.
there's a fine line in there on the march westward. It was gruesome and atrocity when the march was on. After everybody was contained on reservations and everything, and they had what they wanted and had the American Indians contained, yeah, then it went back to normalization, trading with each other, socializing mm-hmm. each other, and then, you know, sticking to the rules of the law of the land, you know, get your red butt out of town before dark, that stuff. That was all going on. But during the march across here, you know, Sand Creek Massacre there in Colorado, they come out of Denver with a militia and killed about 300 men, women, and children under a white flag and an American flag.
Colonel Shivington.
They cut off the Indians' heads and stuck them on sticks, went back to Denver downtown and had a parade down Main Street of Denver with Indians' heads on them, celebrating their victory of killing those people at Sand Creek. And today, an Italian guy has come from New York City that the FBI run out of New York, and he's taken over in the city politics stuff up there, and got Columbus Day started back being celebrated in Colorado back in 2001. And from 2000 up to 2008, we've been coming together all over Canada and the United States, protesting there each year and blocking a parade and getting arrested. And what did they do, the government do? They showed no sympathy. What they did was, over a period of 3 years, changed the laws where that if we did it again the following year, we'd be looking at serious jail time for blocking the parade.
Mike, what? Maybe you should get him to honor Colonel Shivington. He was a colonel that was responsible for the Sand Creek Massacre. And maybe by you having a group in there to make it seem so ridiculous that maybe that they could see the parallel to the genocide of what happened with Columbus.
That's true. Often humor can deliver a message.
They don't give a rat's butt.
Or maybe they could even get Colonel Shivington to march in the parade, or maybe you guys could make a big FUG, you know, like in marching like the Burning Man down the main street of Pueblo, Colorado.
Well, we've even, you know, even up here today, we protested against CNN down there when Ted Turner on CNN and all the television shows and programs and stuff, the Atlanta Braves. the misuse of American Indians as mascots and stuff, the Atlanta Braves, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Washington Redskins. You know, I put out press release and stuff, and I said, okay, if this is not a race, if this is not, you know, showing disrespect to the American Indian community and stuff, I said, then why don't we start up a national league here, call it the Washington Blackskins, see how many African-American players will play on that team and keep their mouth shut.
Or the New York Climbies or the, you know,
the Kansas Honkies or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it could get far. It could get funny.
Hang on to those thoughts right now. Hang on to those thoughts because it is time for us to take a break. Folks, while we're away from your computer, go ahead and take a look at our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. There's a page there about a little bit about Mike as well as a link to his website. And we will be back in just a few minutes with more with Mike Graham and our co-host, Keith Sokola.
And if anybody out there can tell me for a fact there's an American Indian playing for the Atlanta Braves today, I'd really like to know if there's one on the team.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm Gia Scott, and tonight I am joined by my co-host, Keith Sokola, and we're having a great conversation with Mike Graham about the Indian Holocaust and other Indian issues. Now, Mike, before we get started, you want to tell everybody where to find your website?
If you go to UnitedNativeAmerica.com, that'll bring our website up, and there we've got American Indian history for the tribal nations, the federal government, historical events, and press releases that we put out over the past several years here, and issue pages detailing issues that we've dealt with you know, schools and state governments, federal governments that we've taken on over, you know, down through the years. We got those issues posted there for people to review. And it's, you know, good for classwork. Teachers get a lot of classwork from there and everything. A lot of college students come across my website there, and they tell me, even like the lady that's on the was on the Cherokee Nation Council, her son in college had to do some kind of report deal for his class that he was in and everything. And she said the information he used off our website and everything, he got an A-plus out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's good information there. Factual information is backed up. It can't be, you know, it's real stuff. It's documented.
So great information there, folks. So definitely check it out. And let's get back to talking about our topic. You were talking about, you mentioned on while we were on break about the case in Florida with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, and mentioned a similar case that had occurred in another state, with South Dakota. Was it South Dakota?
It's South Dakota, yeah, about 3 years ago, up there in one city there. An Indian boy had just graduated out of high school. He was enrolled in college, going to be an engineer, I believe it was. And him and a buddy of him was out in the neighborhood there, and they were leaving it, and something took place, some altercation or something, and the cops ended up being called out there. And this officer pulled up and confronted the two boys, and at the end of it, neither one of them had a weapon, but the officer did shoot the boy. I think he shot him two or three times. It killed him. And there was a big uproar, you know, there in the community about, you know, the officer's actions and everything, that the boy was basically unarmed, no threat to the officer, and there was other officers coming up on the scene, and the state government, governor's office investigated and everything, and they just washed it under the rug. And there was no national media outcry, no nothing from the national media. CNN, Fox, NBC, CBS, all these guys didn't even want to hear about it, and it was going out in the local papers. Rapid City, just outside of Rapid City, South Dakota, there's where it happened. And no national news group picked it up. And I mean, it's a known fact, it's a documented fact that there on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in White Clay, it's just an alcoholic, you know, liquor store town to sell liquor to the Indians on the reservation, which liquor is banned from the reservation there. And that town's just a half a mile off the reservation land. That's all that town exists for, is selling liquor and beer to the Indians on the reservation there and getting them hooked on it. And the state of Nebraska, it's in the state of Nebraska there, keeps allowing these stores to operate there with their licenses and everything. And they have a large police force there for a town that's about a half a block long with stores on both sides of it. No homes around there except for the store owners living there. That's the town. It's a liquor beer store town. And there's been around 300 American Indian men and kids that are killed in that area. And they're unsolved murders, homicides, around 300 people killed, and none of these murders have been solved. And that's not even hitting national news. Now you tell me, in the South or the North or California or any other state out here, that if you had 300 black people killed or Jewish people killed or any other ethnic or racial group of people killed over a period of time, that there would not be a severe federal investigation going on. It's not happening because, again, here the news media, national news media groups, hear about all this in the local papers, but they will not pick it up and make it a national issue for the American Indian community to show what's happening to them from coast to coast in this country. It's a news blackout, and it sucks to high hell that our media groups out here pine and moan and groan for everybody else when we know darn good and well they're turning their back on the American Indians today, and they're not reporting the exploitive nature and events that are taking place out here toward the American Indians. And I told them, what's wrong with corporate America here and state governments, the federal government, that they got such a bone about American Indians making a buck. No pun intended. But any time an American Indian tries to make a dollar or anything here, the tribal nations try to set up a business enterprise or something, the state comes in and files all kinds of motions trying to block them from doing it. They tie the tribal courts up, tribal nation up in court for years, cost them tens of thousands up into the millions of dollars just trying to get a freaking business open up to get someone a job, with the unemployment running over 50% on most Indian nations out in the western states here. And this is being done through the county government, state government, and the federal government allowed to go on and doing a blackout on it and not reporting it. That's what's happening. In 2000, the same thing that happened to me when I was in the fourth grade, 2000, there in Montana, a school, Wolf Point School. The white teachers there were taking Indian children, corporal punishment. Anything they did, any little thing they did wrong, they took them out of the classroom, locked them up in a plyboard room, 2.5 foot long, 2 foot wide, all day long, for days at a time. When they come to school, they had to go to that room and sit there on a stool in that little cubicle and were not allowed out. And they were going home with their clothes soiled because they wouldn't even let them out to even go to the bathroom. No teachers fired. The white superintendent of the Indian school, no problem with him or his wife. He was working under him there, getting good pay for running the school and keeping Indians out as teachers and then treating Indian children that way on a reservation school. In 2001,
that's
2002,
you,
this
you thinking
going on
about
right here in
doing that to someone That's horrible. I suffer from claustrophobia.
This is going on in America.
Imagine.
This is going on in America. The good old USA, running around the world with our sons and daughters, having them get slaughtered on battlefields for other people that have millions of people in their country. If they feel the need to overthrow their government, I say send them 25 shiploads of guns and ammunition and tell them to get rid of them. We don't have to send our sons and daughters over and put them on the battlefield. That's corporate America, the same way Vietnam was run. It was a corporate America federal government campaign to corporate America here to build ships, guns, trucks, ammunition there and throw it away, killing innocent people for, what, 10, 15 years, and then holler uncle and then run out. And then look what happened. The North Vietnamese and the communists took over Vietnam, South Vietnam. And they're basically doing the same thing with this war in the Middle East. Send our sons and daughters over there. When them people over there can fight their own war, their own self. And we're doing this to our kids here, and the national news media, every 10 minutes on CNN and Fox, is reporting about this young man down there being shot by a neighborhood watch guy who's claiming that he's defending himself. Whatever the facts are, if an Indian kid out here gets beat up and stabbed and killed by the cops, shot, CNN and Fox don't want to hear about it. You can call them up. Oh, yeah, is that right? We'll check into it. That's all that happens. That's sick.
So it might be interesting that in a Tulsa where the shootings were just racially charged, that if you look at the pictures of the two claimed white shooters, one of them has Native ancestry, you can tell. That's going to gain media attention as well.
They're giving it news time, and the guy flipped out because a black man killed his daddy. And they can use the racial deal if they want to, but most usually when someone kills your daddy, it don't matter what color of skin you are, you usually want to go kill them yourself, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a situation there. Or a young guy says, hey, you know, you killed my dad? Hey, you know, I'm tired of this crap. I want to take somebody out. Yeah, he lost it, and he should be held accountable for what he did, too.
Yeah. All these issues, you know, like...
He should be held
in the news.
And you know, Mike and Gia, these stories, these hideous stories, will stack up on and on. That's what's so atrocious about the whole thing is that, you know, like when you're telling this story, I can think of three other stories offhand, you know, like that are similar in different locations and different regions in North America, even in Canada, where the issue of the Native issues are significant, the First Nation issues up there are significant with relationships between people. But this happens and it's going on almost simultaneously throughout Indian country.
Well, just here within the last few months, Indian girl up in Wisconsin was talking to her girlfriend in the hallway, and one of the other white teachers there is a Catholic school just off the Indian reservation where they were going to school. No doubt, that's the way it is. And the teacher or say something in her own language. And she took it that the girl was talking dirty and ended up suspending the girl for talking in her own Indian language in a hallway on a break. Now, that didn't go national. No big deal. But it got out on the Internet to my group.
Yeah, because I read about that case on the Internet. And so it did. The Internet is creating sort of a level playing field for everyone because information is available in a different way, from this program to blogs to alternative news. All sorts of things are available for the first time. But there again, maybe the Native American community doesn't have that same level playing field because on a lot of reservations, especially the poorer ones and the more remote ones, Internet accessibility isn't necessarily up to par.
It's not.
I know even in Winslow, Arizona, which is not on the reservation, It's just south of the reservation. There's limited accessibility if you're not in the town itself. Because when I lived there, I had that issue. To this day, still, broadband, DSL, not everybody has access to that. And today, you cannot use dial-up and load many websites. It won't work. It's too slow.
Yeah, those days
the computer
are
says, no.
And the other big deal that CNN and these guys and Fox and all them, they want to make a big deal out of racial profiling by cops out here across the country. Racial profiling started against American Indians on a reservation. When the U.S. Army was called off of them, local county cops and city cops patrol the borders of any reservation in this country. And anytime they see a car and they know it's loaded, it's got Indians in it, Indian people, they will follow that car for however many miles they have to till they deem they're in a remote area where the people can't dispute what they say, or they actually see them do some little minor thing wrong to get to pull that car over. And then they make those people sit out there for hours on end while they tear through their vehicle and everything and question them and try to find anything else they can write them up for, and terrorizing the mom and dad and the kids. Dakota, if you leave off that reservation, going off the reservation out to another city there in the state, you will go through a barrage of county, state, local cops lined up and down the roadways to the cities that you're going to be traveling to, and you're probably going to be stopped about 10 times trying to drive at least 50 or 60 miles getting to the next town. And stories of Indian children laying down in the back seat crying, begging their parents not to leave the reservation because the bad man cops will take them away from them and put them in a foster home. That's how the churches are conducting getting Indian children away from their Indian parents today, is that if they find anything wrong with that car or those people, they put those children under state control and get them adopted out. And, yeah, they've got a law where those Indian children are supposed to go back to a family member or an Indian home there on a reservation. That's not they're bypassing that. They're not doing it. The ACLU is after South Dakota right now because they're not honoring that law. They're handing them out to churches there in the state so the churches can get children on welfare and draw money off of them, off the state. That's what it's all about, and taking kids away from Indian parents across this nation. That's sick. CNN and Fox won't report it. That is sick. It is a real issue going on today.
It's hard to...
I cannot imagine someone taking away my kids, okay, for a parent, that's got to be your worst nightmare.
Well, when you're stuck on a reservation and you don't have transportation and you don't have a phone because of the piss-poor politics of the tribal government having to kiss the federal government's butt to get a dollar to even stay in business as a tribal government, that's how the federal government and corporate America does it. Show me a freaking reservation across the country that has a freaking McDonald's on it or a Walmart. No. Corporate America runs from reservations. They want them to be starved off that land. The poverty rate is sky high. You're going to be eating jackrabbits and rats the rest of your life if you want that land. How long do you want it?
Here's another question for you two guys, both of you. Indian casinos are a big thing nationwide. I know that they exist in Arizona. I know they exist in Minnesota, and they exist in many other states. What I'm wondering is when the tribes bring them in and they're up and running, do these casinos actually employ members of the tribe, or are they managed by members of the tribe? Or is it end up where it's mostly outside and therefore white employees?
There's a joke, Gia, that they used to say, how come they have Italian restaurants at Indian casinos? And the punchline was so that the management wouldn't get homesick for their food. But you know, I think we're getting close to that whole, that oppressive pedagogy where people start mimicking the actions of people who've been oppressing them for centuries. And unfortunately, I think casinos are in their hands, and me being on the first line of native entertainment, and I've been hired in some casinos where, you know, they are sovereign, and for the most part, though, you know, if native entertainers are crying about how could we get more jobs at casinos, and we've always tried to placate the tribal governments, but it's almost like they're not the ones controlling the casinos. Just get after these white tourists that go into these things and get them to support you. You might have more luck. I think I would, you know.
Well, for the Oklahoma reservation, I mean the casino there, because I worked at the Cherokee Bingo Hall and it went casino. Their deal is, yes, if you walk in there and they got a position to fill and you got an Indian card and you're qualified, you'll get the job. And they make pretty good money off of them. And the tribal government, in turn, the Cherokee Nation, had this all out with the Freeman Group back there two or three years ago. And the Cherokee Nation just got fed up with it and put out the full financial statement of where the money goes. And it's education, health, and poverty issues and education issues that the money goes for the casinos. And they are doing it in the Cherokee Nation with the money. It's going there for the health and education of the tribal government and the communities and building roads and homes. And the federal government keeps cutting their budget the more money they make. Well, there goes about $15 million down the road. The government's going to send down to Atlanta and build a real nice apartment complex for a couple of welfare families down there.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, we're doing it ourselves. The heck with the federal government in the state of Oklahoma. The other tribes in the other states, I've been in them. Yes, they have. In Oregon, I've been to a couple of the casinos up there, and they're hiring their tribal members, and they're working. They're doing good.
Well, even though I'm talking even on a higher level as far as, like, how about hiring native entertainers, you know, like...
I'm with you on that, buddy.
I see it all the time, you know, like where you can't, like they'll hire like the biggest country star, the latest one, and here you have an act as good or better and more entertaining, and they'll offer a native act $5,000 and they'll offer the country act, you know, $125,000.
It happens all the time.
I mean, like, it just happened to me the last week. In trying to get two natives to fight over a small pie, you know, like that's about it.
I hear you. That part, you're right. On the entertainment across the nation, any casinos are booking in with some agency that is rotating these rock and roll and country entertainers around the country and bringing them in there, and they're not bringing up the American Indian entertainers that are out here that they could get the notoriety and become stars themselves, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I feel it. I see it, you know. I mean, I feel like my national act is like was a national jam band, and it still is, and we can bring high level.
The American Indian entertainment industry people, yourself and all those people involved in that, should organize a group and go to the American Indian Gaming Commission and hammer down on them.
Well, I was Mike. They just had that NIGA out in San Diego, and you know the same thing happens there. I mean, God bless Dwight Yoakam, and his bass player is a wonderful guy who does all kinds of native things. But they have Dwight play there, and so like all the big casino buyers can come in and see that, and they hire no Indian acts, and his are national leaders. Are filling in that prophecy, you know, that self-fulfilling prophecy of non-belief. I can't really believe that, but it's happening. I mean, I see it all the time, and we clamor over these acts, and these are a lot of times rednecks who don't care about the communities they play in. They just want to gouge and take from them again and gone, you know, on their tour bus, and hardly will even get out to breathe the air.
It's just
in
like
the community.
I mean, he's a real filthy rich guy. Got his own show every week. he travels around the country, and he's booked into a lot of Indian casinos telling his jokes because he's a star. The casinos want him to come there. They throw money at him to come there to bring in a crowd for, you know, the machines and eat and dine and get a room, you know. But they're not looking, they're not taking the money that the casinos bring in and setting up a music.
Yeah, helping us manage ourselves, be better songwriters, be better businessmen. You know, I agree.
They could change it around at the back end at the tribal government, that a percentage of that casino money goes for the entertainment part, schooling of Indians going to the colleges and stuff that want to be actors, want to be entertainers, that they've got the funding to go to those schools and get their entertainment skills honed down and get themselves on the road to, if they want to become a musical star or something. You know,
and it ain't even that. Also, the whole career building thing that comes with the industry of entertainment, because there might be one singer or a band out there, but they need a road manager. If you're going to do a TV show, you need to have, you know, the facilities to record that. All the kind of offshoots come from.
Well, to me, I'm saying the American Indian Gaming Commission should establish an American Indian Entertainment College and acting schools and stuff. Will you come to that college for those skills and learn them there?
Great idea.
Need to start at the junior high and high school level because, hey, guys, that's where I started. Public speaking with drama class, with competing as a speaker, with storytelling, with, you know, and okay, I'm old, okay, for anybody who's out there that doesn't remember a time before video cameras. When I was in high school, video cameras were very expensive, so were VCRs. Nobody had them at home. We had them in the school to use because as an entertainer, you have to learn how to better do it better. What better way than to watch yourself? So we were actually being videotaped. And so we could watch ourselves and see what we'd done wrong rather than just get a critique from a teacher. And all that really has to start at the high school level to let people explore the idea of whether or not they really want to do it. Not everybody wants to get up in front of an audience. Not everybody wants to get up, even come up. Like right now, you know, we have a huge listening audience. If we were all looking at them in the eye, we wouldn't be able to, you know, count them. And for some people, that's very, very intimidating. You really need to start to hone those skills as an adolescent. And if you're not presented with the opportunity, which it doesn't sound like it's likely to be presented in a school on a reservation, then, you know, so it really does need to start, like a lot of other things, just like us learning to treat each other with respect. We start learning that as children.
But, you know, this is interesting because we're kind of coming around to the issues of, like, the Holocaust and image. You know, we've talked about a lot of things from the word squaw to boarding schools to Holocaust. And now we're actually coming down to ways that we can heal and ways that we can educate and how we can go forward, you know, without this poisoning ourselves, so we have become so great. You know, that's one of my biggest things I always ask for, you know, forgiveness. And
well,
to forgive those.
If you take a group of kids and put them together, little kids, you know, two-year-olds, they have no idea about racism. We teach this to our kids. And all we need to do is to quit doing that and start teaching them tolerance and acceptance and respect for each other. And, you know, we will come a long ways towards.
Well, we need programs. We need songs. We need shows. We need, you know, stories. And it's kind of an interesting time, you know, to be. All of these things as a storyteller.
It'd be interesting to see a sitcom about a Native American family, wouldn't it?
yeah. I don't know what we could call it.
There's never been one.
I think in Canada now that APTM Network is a little bit more progressive because they've had a national network. And I know, like, in nationally, there is a movement to get a national Indian TV network. Mike, perhaps you know something more about that. I don't know where that is.
They've already established one in Canada. Has a network, Indian network.
Does the ATPN, Aboriginal People's Television, it's called.
Yeah, you can access it here. You'd have to call that station up and try to get it through your cable company or something to get access to it. It'd be like a paid deal down here, but it's broadcasted all throughout Canada up there for the American Indian community. But here there's no Native American television station at all going on. They've tried a few times, but they're not getting the backing for it, so it's just not happening. We've been up that road a lot with them and trying to get something going nationally. There's a group up in Washington State that has an Indian TV network program, but it's just in that state. They can't get the backing themselves to even go national with it.
Yeah, I'm sure that I've also heard of a few other networks with some California native backing that are around the Pechanga area or in L.A. area that perhaps there is a network. I mean, it would be something, I think maybe on it'll come out to us after the show and things, and we'll find out more about it.
I'm going to speak a little more here on, you know, my trips out west here, just about, I think about 70 miles west of Albuquerque there's an Indian tribal nation there, and they've got a couple of casinos set up there on Interstate 40. And that tribal group there, they go back to Cortez days when he marched through there and was slaughtering their tribal members and stuff and scattering them to the winds and stuff when he came up through there. Now the federal government has just left them out there to die in the sun. They got the two casinos going up. They got two truck stops and shopping centers going up in them and everything. And I've driven them through their nation. And they have all new schools, brand new schools, homes, paved roads. They're living nice now. They're taking care of themselves. It's not the federal government doing it. They're doing it. And they're out in the middle of nowhere.
What town are you speaking about, Grants?
Oh, I wish I could think of it. It's not coming to my mind right now.
Like it was east or west of Albuquerque.
Laguna is the one I'm thinking he might be talking about. It seems to me they were putting in casinos in Laguna.
Laguna and Route 66.
The casino's name is Sun City, right there on Interstate 40.
Uh-huh.
And what the tribal group has, about 15 miles down off of 40, there's a big plateau up there that still has the ruins of their village. And
yeah.
you can go there. They've got a museum up with their history in their brand new building with the museum and everything, all the artifacts and stuff. And
Acoma does have a beautiful museum.
That village was
Mesa.
Built in the 1600s is when Cortez comes through there, you know, doing all this crap to them. And that village up on that plateau is still there, and you can go up there and take tours through it.
Looking for the city of gold, Cibola, hey?
Yeah. My mom actually went up to Acoma when she was a child. At that time, they were just building the road. There was no road up to Acoma. And they walked up, they hiked up the mesa on the trail. And the people there and a family invited them in. They ate food there with them and then walked down and climbed in whatever vehicle they were traveling in and went on their way because they lived in their Grants at the time. But, yeah, she tells a story about it. She was quite impressed with her trip to Acoma.
It's an awesome place.
But the Sky City is what it's referred to, and it's the oldest continually inhabited city in America.
Yeah.
I thought that was, O'Reilly, but that church there and that whole place is competing.
Well, they both say claim that they are the oldest continually, you know. So
I know exactly what you're talking about.
They're both very old cities, you know. Yeah, and it's a beautiful area for anybody who's never visited it. It is absolutely gorgeous. I don't have any pictures of that area. I don't think on my computer. I know I don't have any on the website, but really, really gorgeous. it's well worth spending some time.
Well, I think it's Mount Taylor that's the sacred mountain there of the Acoma people. And, you know, like the, it also is significant of marking boundaries of the Diné people. Talk about the four sacred peaks in their area that they mark their homeland, and Mount Taylor is probably on the southeastern corner of their territory. And the Pueblo Indians who are around Acoma and around Laguna, you know, that area in there, you know, they're on the roof of the roof of the world there, you know, with that, mm-hmm. with their prayers and their kivas and all the people there, you know, it's a very central spot, you know, very central spot to North America as well, very powerful. And it's so good to see prosperity come to people who've suffered so long. I mean, were you referencing the cities of gold and Cortez's, his, you know, the Coronado's quest for the city of gold and all these other Spanish ramifications that came up and deprived so much, you know, that pretty much triggered the Pueblo Revolution, you know, in the 1600s.
Yeah, for anybody who's never studied the Pueblo Revolution or uprising or whatever word you want to use, look it up, because it was the most amazing thing. There was no American army or Spanish army that could have duplicated their efforts, because they coordinated their attack over hundreds of miles against the Spanish priests and oppressors that they had there, right down to the hour. Mm-hmm. And so when you read about that incident, when they essentially drove out the priests and whatnot, It's amazing. I mean, you can't help but say, whoa, you know, how'd they do that?
There's one story there that those guys put up with when the Spaniards came through there, what they were doing to break the Indians' resistance against them was that they took, I think it was anywhere between 100 and 700 Indian men between the ages of 12 and 20, and they cut one of their feet off where they could not come at them again.
Yeah.
And that's a true fact. And that Spaniard guy, I don't know if it's Cortez or not, one city out there in New Mexico, the community there had the balls to put up a statue of this idiot on a horse, and some Indians got together and went down there one night with a acetylene torch and cut off his bootleg. And it took it off, and then they cut it up into small pieces. So that
uh-huh.
makes papers there for that area.
Yeah, we were talking about earlier about the lack of Native American television in the United States. I've done the internet. There is nativetelecom.org. And Arrows, which is broadcast, I know, on a number of Native American stations, they broadcast on there. They also have some videos and whatnot. I haven't really explored it. You can buy the videos and whatnot, but I haven't explored to see what they've got there available there. So that's you know, another resource for people that are curious what there is out there. Now, it's not TV, but it's something.
And
you know,
this kind of comes to where we're at this program, you know, like how do we germinate this? How do we make it so the seeds go further, you know, so that people start planting these seeds and ideas and things? And that was always my intentions and hopes of participating in this series, you know. I mean, I learned a lot listening today to our two participants of the radio show, and a lot of times I just didn't want to say anything because, you know, you learn so many things. The thoughts presented in a safe kind of way, in a way that we just have to listen. I really appreciated the efforts of where we're going with this program and where we're going nationally and internationally as well.
Well, 1997.
Yeah. So where would you like to see it go next, Mike?
Well, I was going to say in 1997, I put it out. in a press release and got it out in the media through the Indian community across the country. We went to Washington, D.C. and held a protest on the U.S. Capitol front steps. And before I went up there, we put out in the Washington Times a little flyer thing that people could fill it out and join our group and mail it back to me, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I even put my phone number. I was so gullible then. I put my phone number and address on there for them to send it back to me at my home. Well, as soon as that hit the Times up there in Washington, D.C., I received several death threats that if we showed up there, that I'd be shot on the steps of the Capitol speaking up for Indians, Redskins.
Well, now, you know, there's these new laws
that was
where and when you protest.
We went there, we showed up, the Capitol Police treated us like crap. They were all over us. They weren't amused by us. They didn't want to help us or do nothing. They didn't even want us to be there. They sat out in front of us in the armored vehicles, pointed at us, watching us the whole time we were up there on the steps. And any time they seen a sign being laid down on the steps, they'd break out of that vehicle and run up there and ask whose sign that was. And they said if they catch it laying on the steps again, that person would be going to jail. I mean, they were assholes.
You know, it's convenient. A couple of years ago, I was out at the Longest Walk, they're commemorating it. And the movement had, or the people there, they had a really prime area, you know, like they were right underneath the Washington Monument, you know, and they're gaining national and international press. And all of a sudden, the National Museum of the American Indian had money for them. So they got them to move their powwow on the corner of 4th Street and, like, by the Capitol so that people wouldn't see them as much. But it's interesting the degree and depth of attitude towards protest in D.C., and, you know, saying that you were almost received death threats or received them to now they're kind of like trying to, there's no stopping us, so they kind of try to brush us off and Photoshop us out of the picture, kind of.
Well, they fine-tune the protesting thing now. Now city governments are saying, okay, if you're going to protest an event that we're authorizing in our city, we're going to authorize you to protest 10 miles over here on the other side of the city. You're not even close to the event. They won't even let you get close to an event.
Yeah, it's a pretty good way. And it's a national event. There was like Danny Grover was there and Daryl Hannah and Perry Belafonte. And so it was, you know, like it was, people were there and they were kind of presenting things, but it was almost like that city ordinance, like just moving away from the action and the scene and things like that.
Yeah, they protesting today is nothing. Within the last 4 years, city governments across the country in their mayor and governor meetings have got together, and they're putting protesters way off isolated where that if anything does break out or try to happen, then they can bring the SWAT teams in real quick and it don't even get close to the activities that the protest is against.
You know, two other subjects real quick. We're kind of talking about the Holocaust in America. And, you know, what I see a lot of it is almost like a racial environmental breaking of policies. You know, now, for instance, with the new tar sands pipeline coming through, they're really putting pressure on tribal governments. And, to bring it through and offering the monies and things like that. Have you guys seen any of this kind of movement nationally?
The Indian groups out on the internet and the ones I'm involved with, like on Facebook and everything, got the pictures going out showing what the land looks like after at these tar sand pits where they destroyed the ecology and everything, you know? And it's not worth it. It is freaking not worth it.
Well, it's almost the same, you know, like let's cause a Holocaust to a people, but let's cause the Holocaust on the land as well.
Yeah, I mean, almost. You talk about dripping in the land. I mean, it is just barren. Nothing. Nothing's going to grow back there.
I grew up on an iron range in northern Minnesota, and there's literally a hole that runs a mile deep and 66 miles long, you know, like from iron ore mining, open pit mining.
Guys, guess what? We are running out of time. Mike, you want to tell everybody real quick where your website is?
Okay, yes. UnitedNativeAmerica.com. You can pick us up there. And like I say, spread the word on this. Everybody, get involved out here with your school children and everything and your teachers to bring American Indian true history in and work with your tribal nation groups out there that they get the history out. The Indian nations in Oklahoma right now, in their commercial, they're putting out advertisement spots daily and weekly on the different tribes there and our history and everything and what we're doing for the ecology, the environment, keeping the waterways clean in Oklahoma and everything. The tribal nations are putting these advertisements out and talking about how many people they employ within the state and everything. So that's the movement in Oklahoma right now.
All right. Well, Keith, real quick, you want to tell everybody where to find your website?
Secola.com, SECOLA.com. And also I'm on Facebook, and you can Google me and find out where I'm playing and things and what I'm doing. And hopefully, Gia, maybe you could post that song about the American Indian Holocaust on your website or something, or I'll have it up soon on my next release.
Okay, all right, I'll do that. Well, folks, I hope that tonight's program has given you all plenty of food for thought as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we continue our Native American Voices series and another program that is sure to be just as thought-provoking. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm Gia Scott, and good night.
Down at the radio wall, catch the wind in a freight car.